You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, welcome to Real Living. This is Lavinia Spirito with Mary Lou Nemecek. And we are continuing to unpack for you our trip to the Holy Land.
We've lost count of how many times we've been talking about the trip in order of the series, but we still haven't reached the end. There's still so many things to talk about.
Well, and plus, I know we kind of go, we divert a little bit. We go on little rabbit trails, but I think that there isn't really an uninteresting detail about the Holy Land.
No,
When you go back and you look into it. We were going to talk a little bit about the pools of Bethesda. Now, of course, you know, in America, as in all over really the West, there are places everywhere that have biblical names, right?
Absolutely.
So in America, in Maryland, of course, we can think about the naval base at Bethesda in Maryland. And it comes straight from the biblical appellation of the pools of Bethesda, which were unearthed in 1871. Excavations carried close to St. Anne's Church uncovered the remains of two large rectangular pools, which were probably part of the mikvot, one mikvah, two mikvots, of the ceremonial washing pools in or around Jerusalem and the temple. There was a man in the Gospel of John who was doing his darndest to get into the pool because apparently the pools had the reputation of having healing waters, but only after the water somehow mysteriously was ruffled and it was thought by the hand of an angel, right?
Right.
So that's the setup. There's a whole lot more that our guide told us about, and I can't remember and you can't remember, but basically Jesus confronts the guy because he says, hey, the guy says, he says, do you want to be healed? And the guy says, I've been trying and there's nobody around to help me to get in the pool. The man was paralyzed.
This has been for years.
At 38 years, it talks about bondage. And Jesus looks at him. You know, Jesus knows everything, right?
Right.
And he just looks. It's almost like, you know, Padre Pio had the gift of reading of souls. It would have been one of those moments, you know, in which he looks at him and he says, really? Really? You've been here for 38 years and you still haven't found a way to get in the pool? I mean, you know, so he deals with the inner sin, not so much the outer corruption, the paralysis,
right,
the illness, the physical illness. He needs to address first the illness of the soul, which is probably unrepented sin. I mean, there's all kinds of theories.
Sure. Which we can all identify with. You know, how hesitant would we be in getting in the water and making excuses?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So it's actually a pretty interesting moment because the guy does get healed. I don't remember if he gets in the pool or not. But
it's quite a large area.
It's a very large area.
It's not like a little, you know, little pool over in the corner someplace.
No.
This was a large area where people would go and bathe.
Exactly. So it's actually pretty good. Colonnades divided the pool into sections, and it's believed that sheep were washed in one of these pools before they were sacrificed. In the temple.
Oh, in the temple.
Which, you know, before you're running water and garden hoses and pressure washers and pressure washer nozzles and handles, which is what I would think of. You'd need to rinse off something as dense as a sheep with wool attached to it would be. That was probably the most, practical solution. And that is also, I think, a solution to why all these mikvots, these mikvah baths, these ceremonial ritual ablutions baths were really all over the place because of the fact that running water really wasn't available and people were on dusty, unpaved streets every day in contact with animals and sewage and all that kind of stuff. So something had to happen. So that was, I thought that was very interesting. He gave us a long story, which I cannot believe, I cannot remember. I think somebody wrote it down. We're going to have to get one of our people to remind us. Now, we talked about going to the Wailing Wall, didn't we? Have we done the Wailing Wall
yet? We have.
We have done the Wailing Wall.
That was the day that was pouring down rain. That was really the only day we had bad weather.
All right. So obviously, I'm going to the itinerary the wrong way. The Church of Dominus Flevit, we didn't get to go to it, but some of us did. And it's a beautiful church that commemorates the tears of Jesus that he shed while looking over Jerusalem. And it is, of course, on the Mount of Olives, overlooking the Temple Mount, because you have these beautiful
pictures.
Oh,
yeah, you look through the window and you can see it. And that's what's so remarkable is that everything is so close. You think that it's far away, but you could be over in Gethsemane mm-hmm. and be looking right across the way to where the temple,
stood. It gives you a sense of the immediacy, especially standing mm-hmm. on the traditional site of the Garden of Gethsemane. Because Jesus really, he didn't even, almost he didn't need binoculars to see what was going on in the city, considering the temple itself in white marble with gold accents and gilt would have been unmistakable and would have been the dominating landscape.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can picture
marker.
The soldiers coming over for Jesus with their torches and coming mm-hmm. up, going down the hill, crossing the bottom of the valley and coming back up. I mean, it's just remarkable how the topography there is mm-hmm. is still intact, although, you know, the buildings have changed. But you can still tell in that where everything was located.
It lends itself to understanding when Jesus says that he saw that they were coming.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
You know, that Judas and the temple servants and guards. That night, we had a great treat, which I think is probably one of the things the legionnaires do best, which is the shroud exhibit. We saw the exhibit of the shroud the first time we stayed at the Notre Dame guest house in Jerusalem. And we also saw, those of us who went to Rome together on the trip, the Padre Pio trip, we also saw their shroud exhibit there. It's something that they've just specialized on, and they've made a lot of pride out of presenting this exhibit of the shroud. Now, when we speak about the shroud, of course, we're talking about the supposed burial cloth of Jesus, which was in the property of the Italian royal family, the Piedmontese royal family, from about the 1300s on. Before then, you have kind of a spotty record on how this shroud traveled all the way from Jerusalem through Odessa or Edessa, and there are records actually of this burial cloth kind of making its way over land, of kind of being hindered by the invasion of the Persians and being hidden, and then coming back to the Holy Land in fits and starts, coming back to Europe in the fits and starts. We find it in the chapel or as part of somebody's dowry in the 1100s and 1200s, and it's then that it finally becomes at the Chambéry, it becomes a part of the Savoia's family, the Savoy family.
And that's where the fire occurred, where it was damaged?
And that it occurred in the Chapel of Chambéry in 14-something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have the silver fastenings of the chest in which it was kept folded. The fire was so intense that the silver clasps melted and damaged some of the edges of the folded cloth. To the point where it had to be repaired, and you have 14th century repairs,
right.
little patches done on the edges of the cloth. And unfortunately, it looks like those were the ones that were tested with the radiocarbon dating, which you would think,
that was back in the 80s. When
might not happen
that.
Because mm-hmm. really, because that's when the radiocarbon dating was done on the shroud. They chose to for some reason, they took the material off the patches that had been made in the 1300s. So that's why I made the shroud itself date itself to the 1300s. But in fact, of course, it was not. You know, all the details, it's a 14-foot length cloth, and it contains the imprint. It's a very vague, a very sort of subtle imprint when you look at it with the naked eye. You can see the outline of a man and you can see his face, but it's very, very thinly mm-hmm. available. It wasn't really until the invention of photography at the end of the 1800s when one photographer, it occurred to him to make a negative image. Well, it didn't occur to him. He, in the process of developing the photograph, the negative image came up and it was so much clearer. Mm-hmm. On the negative image, that this, in fact, really was the outline of a man. And it shows all these amazing details.
The difference between the first time we saw this exhibit and this last time is that they've done like a hologram, mm-hmm. which was so spectacular because they would set it up and you would like walk towards it and you could see it like in a three-dimensional. In one line, we saw the front of the shroud, and then we would go to the other line, you would see the back of it. So you could see all the all the details, unlike any other way we've ever looked at them. And it was spectacular because you could see so much of the details of the wounds and the outline of the body, et cetera. And it's, you know, when you go through the exhibit and you hear all of the wounds and what happened, and they've counted them and they've been able to determine so many things about the scourging that it's really, people are very quiet and it's almost disturbing to listen to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it makes it so real.
Absolutely. And it's a salutary unease, I think. It's mm-hmm. the kind of thing that we are never really confronted enough with the reality of the sacrifice of Jesus. And especially now that we're studying the letter to the Hebrews, that kind of unpacks the meaning of that sacrifice. It's just so amazing to see what one person went through. I'm looking through, I'm kind of jogging my memory through one of the books that we acquired at the Notre Dame Center having to do with the permanent exhibit of the Shroud. And they have some beautiful pictures, including, of course, the patches and the repairs that were made after the fire. I'm sorry, it was in 1500, so it's in the 16th century, not the 14th century. And this Shroud exhibit is, there's actually a, this is just so crazy. I look at this picture in Nice, done in 1660. And it's a picture of the shroud enthroned over the altar. And there's the picture of the man according to mm-hmm. the shroud, the details of the shroud. So is the shroud a matter of faith? No. Is the shroud one of the things that we have to believe in and part of the deposit of faith? No. But it certainly helps. it's a great describer and it brings us really present to what Jesus must have gone through. When we come back from break, we're going to kind of unpack the various details revealed through the Shroud exhibit that we attended. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you in a little bit.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello and welcome back to Real Living. On the first part of the program, we kind of set up our visit to the Shroud exhibit in Jerusalem at the Notre Dame Center, which is where we were staying. And one of the reasons I wanted us to stay there was because of the accessibility of the Shroud exhibit. Now, they have done, the Legionnaires priest order has done a lot of studies on the Shroud, and they've come up with a lot of very interesting conclusions, which were already available, but they've put them together all in the same place, which is very interesting. Now, the idea was of this 14-foot by 3-foot long strip of Egyptian cotton woven in the traditional basket weave pattern, herringbone pattern that was typical of very fine linen and was also apparently typical of burial shrouds in the first century in Palestine, which was very interesting. Pollen evidence found in the folds of the shroud and examined according to modern methods shows pollen and remains of plants available only in Palestine and blooming in the spring.
Right, because there were flowers that were placed in there.
Because there were flowers mm-hmm. that were placed up, but also pollen.
Right.
You know, so you have this picture of this man hastily buried with flowers in the folds of the garment, but with the idea that somebody was going to come back. And finish. You know, an aside, of course, is the face cloth, which is called a sudarium in the Greek, having to do with it would have been a small cloth that would have been placed over the face of Jesus as he was being prepared for burial. And there was an image also affixed and blood deposited on the sudarium that eventually made its way into the church in Oviedo, Spain. And so it's known as the Sudarium of Oviedo. The chain of custody
right.
in that case is a whole lot less complicated than the one in the shroud. What is interesting is that when they tested the blood type of the blood of the man whose face was covered on the sudarium of Oviedo and the man who was buried in the shroud, they are the same. They are AB, which is typical of Mediterranean men living in that area at the time. So I thought that was fascinating. Then, of course, they cast I just want to go over the other evidence first before we go into the hologram. There was the evidence of the pollen in the folds. There's the evidence, of course, of the man in the shroud was scourged by the classic Roman flagellum or flagrum, or we would call it the cat of nine tails if you've read a lot of pirate stories, but something along those lines. A long handle with two or three leather straps upon which stones and pieces of bone and pieces of metal, sharp, jagged metal, would have been attached so as to scourge the individual. Now, the person in the shroud, it is seen from the details of the shroud, was scourged by two people of unequal height, so a tall person and a shorter person, because they can tell by the direction of the wounds contained on the back of the person of the shroud. So remember that the Jewish law mandated for 39 lashes was the maximum that could be given because the Torah, of course, forbade anything more than 40, and they always went one less in order to be careful, right? That was typical of the Jewish spirit. But the Romans had no such limitations. The Romans didn't have to limit themselves to 40 lashes. They could go further. And there is evidence actually in the first century of people dying from scourged so severely that the whip would raise the tissue, would open up the back of the people, and would actually arrive, get to the point, lay open the flesh all the way where you could see the bowels of the victim because of the so deep of the flagellation of the scourgings. Now, we know that Jesus' scourging was probably more severe than most people because Pilate probably intended just to scourge him and then let him go. Scourge him as an example. But when he came back and he showed them the Ecce Homo, the famous example, here is the man, behold the man, he was overwhelmed and overruled by the whole crowd crying, crucify him, right? So we have the man also, which I thought was a pretty cool detail. The man in the shroud, his eyes were closed and there were coins put on each eyelid. And when you look at them through modern science, was those details available, you see that those are lepta, which is a little denomination available in the time, and they're Pontius Pilate leptas, yes. Meaning they have the name or the likeness of the then procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate, which would be a pretty logical thing to do. You take change out of your pocket and you put
the coins
over the eyelids of the person buried in the shroud. Now, the person buried in the shroud, it reveals that the crucifixion had been first of all, it reveals that the person carrying the cross right before death, or perimortem, as they would say, right around the time of death, sustained two or three unprotected headlong falls. Whereby he actually fractured, I don't know if he fractured, because it says he didn't break any bones. Where actually there was some damage that you could see from these unprotected headlong falls, which would correspond to somebody carrying the crossbeam being lashed to it and not being able to protect themselves if they fell down. And it does say that Jesus fell down. So those are elements, of course, that line up with the gospel. The man in the shroud was crucified, and the 6-inch spikes went through the ulnar nerve at the base of the wrist, so that the man in the shroud shows crucifixion in his wrist and not necessarily in his palms, which is what traditional iconography showed. Right. But unless the man was tied to the crossbeam of the cross, anything in the palm would have stripped out by the weight. So we don't have any evidence that he was tied, but we do have evidence that he was nailed. And the shroud does bear this fact that the spikes went through the base of the wrist to more firmly affix him to the cross. It also shows how the ankles or the feet of the person crucified were affixed to the base of the cross with one large spike. So they were superimposed and they were affixed to the cross that way. Excavations in Jerusalem in the 60s found remains of people who had been crucified. So they obviously accessed some form of a mass grave or something. And they found the remnants of a man in his 20s who had been crucified. And they had to actually cut his feet off because they could not get him off the cross otherwise. Mm-hmm. That was a sign of how strongly and how big the spikes were to affix these people to the crosses. I mean, they were not going anywhere.
No.
You know?
No.
It also gives light to the ridiculousness of the various theories against the resurrection. There's a theory called the swoon theory, where Jesus kind of passed out on the cross and somehow they thought he was dead, even though they ran a spear through his heart. You know, but no, he woke up and somehow the coolness of the tomb revived him. And then he walked 7 miles to Emmaus to scare the pants off those poor disciples. You know, I mean, the whole thing is absolutely ridiculous. So it shows the details of the scourging. It shows the coins on his eyes. It shows the nails going through the palm, through the wrists, and through
the feet.
And so it looks also, there is evidence, of course, of the wound on his side that went through the fourth and the fifth
ribs.
It was a classic, apparently, those who have studied these things say that he was jabbed with a spear, and that particular move was apparently a classic move of Roman soldiers. They were taught that there was a particularly vulnerable spot between the fourth and fifth, or the fifth and sixth intercostal, whereby you could access the pericardium directly. Like, it would be an instant kill shot.
Right. In battle.
So that makes sense also, because that is, in fact, the location. But one of the soldiers opened his side with a lance, and immediately there came out blood and water, John 19, verse 34. So we're just kind of accumulating evidence as to the reliability of the person buried in the shroud. And, you know, I always say, you know, even if it isn't Jesus, it's somebody pretty darn close.
Close.
You know, I mean, there's the kinds of things that we learn from the man buried in the shroud are things that we can apply to Jesus, because they're from the same time period. They suffered the same kinds of things beforehand. The man on the shroud was given a basket of thorns, an inverted basket of thorns that was jammed on his head with the help of a small stick. And they can even estimate the girth of the stick between 3 to 4 inches in diameter.
It's just amazing what they know about this.
From what they know. And so it's not a crown. It's more like a basket, more like an inverted basket of thorns, of very, very sharp thorns of the kind that are available. Imagine that. Are available in Palestine. It would have been available hanging around in the courtyard of the Fortress Antonia, because they were long strips with thorns on them that belonged to a particular plant that was very resilient, and they used to tie firewood up with these bundles of things that happened to sport these wicked thorns. So again, that answers to the reliability of the information that we gain from the guy on the shroud.
But even the face on the shroud, when you see artwork later on depicting Jesus, it's very close to what you're looking at on the shroud.
Absolutely.
So there's something to it. There's some connections here.
There are many more connections than there are not. Let's just put it that way. Also, what I thought was fascinating, and a crying shame, that the facial features of Jesus as given in the shroud reflect almost exactly the images that were produced about Jesus in the Eastern Church before the year 700 and the year 800. So we only have a few of those icons left depicting the face of Jesus, because there was the iconoclastic heresy in the 700s,
which destroyed
all the earliest images of Christ given by eyewitnesses and from the evidence in the shroud, which is a crying shame. But we do have a few. The 6th century icon of Christ Pantocrator in St. Catharus Monastery on Sinai in Egypt would be a classic example of that early understanding of what our Lord looked like from the evidence of the shroud and early iconography. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.